This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Attempts to avoid a global currency war.
Peace talks are going on in South Korea.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, happy Friday. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, October 22nd. Well, central bankers and finance ministers from the Group of 20 Industrialized Nations, the G20 as we know it, are meeting in Seoul, South Korea today. We'll get an update. And later, the city government in Seoul has a warning for those who want to eat a Korean specialty. But first,
the agenda at the G20 in Seoul includes financial reform and regulation, but an even squeakier wheel is getting a lot of grease at the moment: global currencies. Countries have been trying to manipulate their currencies to boost exports, and that's pitting nations against one another. The BBC's John Sudworth is with us from Seoul with the latest. Hi, John.
Hello, Steve.
The meeting wasn't set up to deal with this problem, but currency has come to dominate the agenda. What can they do about it?
Yeah, it's the issue of the day. I think from Europe and America's point of view, what they'd like to see is an agreement that countries stop manipulating their currencies. But of course, that's going to be difficult. I think China, which is obviously the target of that kind of move, is going to be reluctant to sign any sort of a statement which has sort of implied blame of its position. China says that it's really the loose monetary policy in the West that's to blame. So there really is a big difference of opinion here, and it's very difficult to see any easy way of breaking the deadlock.
John, what other issues are they actually there to discuss?
Well, there's technical issues on the table: banking regulation, reform of the IMF, that kind of thing. But the big concern, Steve, is this. You'll remember the optimism of a couple of years ago when people felt the world was going to come together to take action to stop a repeat of the financial crisis. There's concern that these disagreements over currency suggest that after all said and done, the leadership summit next month, meaningful progress may not be so easy to achieve.
All right, the BBC's John Sudworth in Seoul. John, thank you.
It's a pleasure, Steve.
For more on the G20 and the global currencies, we turn now to Chris Lowe. He's chief economist with FTN Financial. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Well, Chris, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner today has asked the G20 members to limit their trade surpluses and trade deficits to a percentage of their own economic output. Now, why does he want that, and does it have anything to do with the global currency war that people are talking about?
Oh, absolutely it does. But the reason he's shifting the conversation is that currency war is so abstract, but trade is concrete. And, you know, trade is one of the few places where you actually have a zero-sum game in economics. If someone's running a big surplus, it means someone else has to run a deficit. And, of course, the biggest trade deficit is here in the U.S., where it took away 3 percentage points from GDP growth last quarter. So that's why he wants to shift the focus in that direction.
And quickly, Chris, do you think that these other finance ministers are going to listen to Secretary Geithner? Do they have anything to gain here?
Absolutely no. He's already got traction. The other G7 developed countries are in the same boat we are, so they're already on board. But he's also getting support from emerging markets, because even though all of them game their currencies, nobody's as good at it as the Chinese. And so countries like Brazil, Chile, Argentina, they'll come on board because it'll put them in a more competitive place, because it'll put actual constraints on Chinese trade.
Okay, Chris Lowe, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, October 22nd. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States. A day after the company announced a massive recall of 1.5 million of its vehicles, Toyota has announced it's going to start producing the Prius in Thailand next month. That's going to mark the first time the hybrid will be mass-produced outside of Japan. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz explains why.
A move to sunny tropical Thailand may seem like the perfect therapy for a company plagued by recalls. But Toyota's not going to Thailand for the beaches. Auto industry expert Jim Russo says a rising currency is cutting into profits at home, and Toyota needs to lower production costs because it's through with selling the Prius to a niche market.
If you're going to be successful in mass marketing these types of vehicles, you need to seek economies of scale, which come from larger production footprints in low-cost markets like Thailand.
The move is part of a broader plan at Toyota to sell 1 million hybrid vehicles a year. So why not seek that economy of scale in a low-cost market like China? First, China forces foreign automakers to enter into joint ventures with Chinese companies. Secondly, hardly anyone in China wants to buy a Prius. Toyota shut down a small assembly plant in China last year due to terrible sales there. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Some good financial news today for U.S. insurance giant AIG and potentially also for us taxpayers. AIG will sell off its valuable Asian insurance business, a move that will jumpstart its plan to pay back more than $100 billion in bailout money. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
AIG was rescued with around $180 billion in taxpayer money as the financial crisis gathered speed 2 years ago. Government officials believed if the giant insurer was allowed to collapse under the weight of bad investments, it would have a devastating effect across global markets. But AIG's core insurance business has remained strong, especially in Asia, where the potential to sell new life insurance policies to a growing middle class is huge. And that explains AIG's success today with the initial public offering of its Asian insurance subsidiary called AIA. The IPO will be worth as much as $20 billion. That money will help AIG make the largest repayment of bailout money to date back to the U.S. Treasury. It's still a drop in the bucket, though. Most of the money AIG owes the government will be recouped as the Treasury sells off its 80% stake in the company on the stock market. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Friday, October 22nd. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. Today, workers at Jimmy John's sandwich shops face a tougher question than what kind of cheese do you want on that. They're voting whether to unionize and become the first U.S. fast food workers to do so. Marketplace's Eve Troe has that.
200 workers from Jimmy John's restaurants around Minneapolis will decide if they want to join the International Workers of the World.
I am voting yes.
Max Spector delivers sandwiches by bicycle. He says when business is slow, he is sent home, so he never knows how much money he'll make. He says other delivery guys have the same issue, so...
Instead of all splitting up and trying to get better jobs, we just come together and organize.
Collective bargaining, I don't know. It's not for me.
Ben McCarthy's been with Jimmy John's about 4 years. He's a no. He thinks unions are for big companies with better jobs.
I don't think that this is a career-type job.
Labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein says this vote could start to change that, the way unionizing transformed longshoremen's work decades ago.
This was the work of bums, drunkards, outlaws, etc. Well, longshore work today is the best-paid blue-collar work in America with steady jobs and high pay.
I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Taylor Swift sure knows how to promote her music. The country singer-songwriter is coming out with a new album on Monday. She's already released one single, which you would know if you were one of her 4.5 million Twitter followers. She's brought a new mastery of social networking to country music, and it's paying off for her. Here to discuss is Pinky Gonzalez, a professor of digital media marketing at Belmont University in Nashville. Pinky, welcome to the show. Thank you for having me, Jeremy. It's exciting to be here.
Well, I was in Nashville recently, and everybody was talking about how Taylor Swift had attracted all these new young fans to country music because she's so well-versed in social networking sites like Twitter and Facebook. What do you make of that?
The reason she has that that distinction, probably more than many in her generation that are coming up now, is that she was already active on MySpace when she became popular. So where a lot of industry executives, to put them in one basket, where they were trying to figure out how should this be used, when should this be used, should we spend any money on it, she was already there using it intuitively.
All right, well, let's get specific here. I've got some of the recent tweets from Taylor's Twitter feed, and let me just read some of them to you, and you can tell me how these help her connect with her fans. Quote, baking pumpkin spice cookies with cream cheese icing because I'm very excited because a new song is coming out on iTunes at midnight. Let me give you another one. Sitting backstage at the Opry. It's been rebuilt since the flood and looks better than new. Abigail flew in to visit. I like today so much.
So personal. She's having a conversation with her friends. And that is the magic. If you compare that to what, say, Kenny Chesney is doing, I would argue that Kenny is also doing a good job with Twitter, but his tweets tend to be more business. This is playing on my radio station right now. It's more data, and you can tell that he has less affinity for the application.
5 years ago, nobody was on Twitter. Do you think that musicians are going to be using it in the same way 5 years from now?
I think musicians will be using whatever Twitter is in 5 years from now, but I doubt it will look like what it looks like today. When I started teaching at Belmont in the fall of 2008, I didn't have a single student that was using Twitter. Today, 100% of my class either uses it or intentionally does not, but there's nobody that didn't know what it was coming into the class.
Pinky Gonzalez, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure and an honor, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
And Steve, it is my life goal to surpass Taylor Swift in the number of Twitter followers. She has 4.5 million.
Yeah. How many do you have?
I think it's just over 50 at this point. But maybe by the time this podcast audience gets there, we'll be up to 4.1 million.
I'm pulling for you, Jeremy.
All right,
I'm
great.
Pulling. You could do it.
All right.
Candidates this year are spending unprecedented amounts of money to get voters to the polls, get out the vote money. But not just any voters. Political parties are using sophisticated databases to find only those people most likely to vote their way. Marketplace's John Dimsdale now on the growing practice of micro-targeting voters.
Like so many political tools, commercial marketing created this one. A decade ago, Ben Juhas worked for credit card companies, finding likely customers more cost-effectively.
If we send out the same amount of mail, get more people to respond, we acquire people for less money.
Using census profiles and credit histories, Juhas aimed advertising directly at the people he figured would like certain types of credit cards. If they were travelers, they would want miles rewards. Savers would want cashback cards. The targeting worked, and by 2004, Juhas was creating a national database of likely Democratic voters for a group of political consultants. The database starts with party registration.
It then adds census data, it adds commercial data, demographics, and you end up with several hundred variables to describe individuals.
Who are receptive to Democratic ideas. Technology has made the data crunching cheap for any candidate. Denver political consultant Rick Ritter describes a recent voter found by micro-targeting.
A woman voter between the ages of 35 and 45 had a Hispanic surname. We could determine that her income was approximately $45,000 a year.
And even if that person is in a traditionally GOP neighborhood, the potential voter will probably get a phone call from this guy.
Hi, this is Barack Obama, calling on behalf of the Ohio Democratic Party.
But some political scientists say micro-targeting can go too far and turn off the broader constituency. Terry Madonna runs the Franklin and Marshall poll in Pennsylvania.
You run the risk that if you drill down too far and become too opportunistic, let me use that word, that may be helpful to a certain group and not helpful to a broader message, you can get yourself into difficulty.
Coming soon, Madonna sees a likely marriage of micro-targeting with mobile technology, and that would mean candidates can micro-target even more, right down to your cell phone. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
State and local officials from coast to coast have been sounding an alarm lately. They're worried that they might not be able to pay the bill for skyrocketing pension and health care costs. Now some regulators are asking new questions aimed at heading off another jolt to the financial system. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
There's fear of a domino effect if too many local governments default on their debt. Insurance companies are some of the biggest buyers of municipal bonds, and regulators who make up the National Association of Insurance Commissioners want to know, are the credit rating agencies adequately factoring in the risk? The firms have issued statements saying they're aware of the challenges facing the municipal sector, but the big three, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch, don't have a great track record.
They disappointed with Enron and WorldCom. They disappointed with mortgage-backed securities. And I think that people are kind of hypersensitive.
Brooklyn Law School professor David Reese says the regulators will be asking some important questions at an upcoming hearing, but finding an alternative to the big rating firms could prove costly.
They are massive organizations that are massively staffed. It's not so easy as picking up the phone and finding another agency that has the resources and just have them kind of replicate their function.
Still, Reese says the bond rating firms need to overcome a reputation for being laggards in predicting trouble. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
And finally, so we told you at the beginning of the program, the G20 finance ministers are meeting in Seoul, South Korea.
Well, that got us thinking if any of them are partaking in octopus heads, a big delicacy on the Korean peninsula.
It's huge over there. Well, the city of Seoul last month upset a bunch of restaurant owners and fishermen by advising people to limit the number of octopus heads that they eat, saying the octopus contains hazardous amounts of poisonous cadmium.
Yum.
Their recommendation, Jeremy, 2 octopus heads per day.
2? I feel like 6 or 7 would be better.
Yeah, I'd need a little ketchup, actually, for that. Yeah. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.